occasion for tonight's address by the President is, of course, the return of the American prisoners from North Vietnam and the withdrawal of American troops from the South. In one sense, this marks the end of the American involvement in the war, and the President is expected to talk about that. He may briefly touch on the continued fighting in Cambodia and Laos. Mr. Nixon will also discuss domestic problems, specifically the economy. There's been widespread speculation that tonight he may announce further steps to stop inflation, especially in the area of food prices. He will doubtless also touch on the current battle between himself and the Congress over the federal budget. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good evening. 4 years and 2 months ago, when I first came into this office as President, by far the most difficult problem confronting the nation was the seemingly endless war in Vietnam. 550,000 Americans were in Vietnam. As many as 300 a week were being killed in action. Hundreds were held as prisoners of war in North Vietnam. And no progress was being made at the peace negotiations. I immediately initiated a program to end the war and win an honorable peace. 11 times over the past 4 years, I have reported to the nation from this room on the progress we have made toward that goal. And tonight, the day we have all worked and prayed for, has finally come. For the first time in 12 years, no American military forces are in Vietnam. All of our American POWs are on their way home. The 17 million people of South Vietnam have the right to choose their own government without outside interference. And because of our program of Vietnamization, they have the strength to defend that right. We have prevented the imposition of a communist government by force on South Vietnam. There are still some problem areas. The provisions of the agreement requiring an accounting for all missing in action in Indochina. The provisions with regard to Laos and Cambodia. The provisions prohibiting infiltration from North Vietnam into South Vietnam have not been complied with. We have and will continue to comply with the agreement. We shall insist that North Vietnam comply with the agreement. And the leaders of North Vietnam should have no doubt as to the consequences if they fail to comply with the agreement. But despite these difficulties, we can be proud tonight of the fact that we have achieved our goal of obtaining an agreement which provides peace with honor in Vietnam. And on this day, let us honor those who made this achievement possible, those who sacrificed their lives, those who were disabled, those who made every one of us proud to be an American as they returned from years of communist imprisonment. And every one of the 2.5 million Americans who served honorably in our nation's longest war. Never have men served with greater devotion abroad, with less apparent support at home. Let us provide these men with the veterans' benefits and the job opportunities they have earned. And let us honor them with the respect they deserve. And I say again tonight, let us not dishonor those who serve their country by granting amnesty to those who deserted America. Tonight, I want to express the appreciation of the nation to others who helped make this day possible. I refer to you, the great majority of Americans listening to me tonight, who, despite an unprecedented barrage of criticism from a small but vocal minority, stood firm for peace with honor. I know it was not easy for you to do so. We've been through some difficult times together. I recall the time in November 1969 when hundreds of thousands of demonstrators marched on the White House. The time in April 1970 when I found it necessary to order attacks on communist bases in Cambodia. The time in May 1972 when I ordered the mining of Haiphong and airstrikes on military targets in North Vietnam in order to stop a massive communist offensive in South Vietnam. And then, and this was perhaps the hardest decision I have made as president, on December 18, 1972, when our hopes for peace were so high, and when the North Vietnamese stonewalled us at the conference table, I found it necessary to order more airstrikes on military targets in North Vietnam in order to break the deadlock. On each of these occasions, the voices of opposition we heard in Washington were so loud, they at times seemed to be the majority. But across America, the overwhelming majority stood firm against those who advocated peace at any price, even if the price would have been defeat and humiliation for the United States. And because you stood firm for doing what was right, Colonel McKnight was able to say for his fellow POWs when he returned home a few days ago, "Thank you for bringing us home on our feet instead of on our knees." Let us turn now to some of our problems at home. Tonight, I ask your support in another battle. But we can be thankful this is not a battle in war abroad, but a battle we must win if we are to build a new prosperity without war and without inflation at home. What I refer to is the battle of the budget. Not just the battle over the federal budget, but even more important, the battle of your budget. The family budget of every home in America. One of the most terrible costs of war is inflation. The cost of living has skyrocketed during and after every war America has been engaged in. We recognized this danger 4 years ago. We've taken strong action to deal with it. As a result of our policies, we have cut the rate of inflation in half from the high point it reached in 1969 and 1970. And today, our rate of inflation in the United States is the lowest of that of any industrial nation in the world. But these positive statistics are small comfort to a family trying to make both ends meet. And they are no comfort at all to the housewife who sees meat prices soaring every time she goes to the market. The major weak spot in our fight against inflation is in the area of meat prices. I have taken action to increase imports from abroad and production at home. This will increase the supply of meat, and it will help bring prices down later this year. But what we need is action that will stop the rise in meat prices now. And that is why I have today ordered the Cost of Living Council to impose a ceiling on prices of beef, pork, and lamb. The ceiling will remain in effect as long as it is necessary to do the job. Meat prices must not go higher. And with the help of the housewife and the farmer, they can and they should go down. This ceiling will help in our battle against inflation. But it is not a permanent solution. We must act on all fronts. And here is where the federal budget comes in. I have submitted to Congress for the next fiscal year the largest budget in our history, $268 billion. The amount I have requested in this budget for domestic programs in such fields as health, housing, education, aid to the elderly, the handicapped, the poor, is twice as big as the amount I asked for these items 4 years ago. However, some members of Congress believe the budget in these areas should be even higher. Now, if I were to approve the increases in my budget that have been proposed in the Congress, it would mean a 15% increase in your taxes or an increase in prices for every American. And that is why I shall veto the bills which would break the federal budget which I have submitted. If I do not veto these bills, increased prices or taxes would break the family budget of millions of Americans, including possibly your own. This is not a battle between Congress and the President. It is your battle. It is your money. Your prices, your taxes, I'm trying to save. 25 years ago, as a freshman congressman, I first came into this office. I met Harry Truman, who was then President of the United States. I remember he had a sign on the desk. It read, "The buck stops here." Now that meant, of course, that a president can't pass the buck to anyone else when a tough decision has to be made. It also means that your buck stops here. If I do not act to stop the spending increases which Congress sends to this desk, you will have to pay the bill. Now, I admit there's an honest difference of opinion on the matter of the federal budget. If you are willing to pay the higher taxes or prices that will result if we increase federal spending over my budget, as some in Congress have proposed, you should ask your senators and your Congress to override my vetoes. But if you want to stop the rise in taxes and prices, I have a suggestion to make. I remember when I was a congressman and a senator, I always seemed to hear from those who wanted government to spend more. I seldom heard from the people who have to pay the bill, the taxpayer. And if your congressman or senator has the courage to vote against more government spending so that you won't have to pay higher prices or taxes, let him know that you support him. Winning the battle to hold down the federal budget is essential if we are to achieve our goal of a new prosperity, prosperity without war and without inflation. I ask you tonight for your support in helping to win this vitally important battle. Let me turn finally tonight to another great challenge we face. As we end America's longest war, let us resolve that we shall not lose the peace. During the past year, we've made great progress toward our goal of a generation of peace for America and the world. The war in Vietnam has been ended. After 20 years of hostility and confrontation, we have opened a constructive new relationship with the People's Republic of China, where one-fourth of all the people in the world live. We negotiated last year with the Soviet Union a number of important agreements, including an agreement which takes a major step in limiting nuclear arms. Now, there are some who say that in view of all this progress toward peace, why not cut our defense budget? Well, let's look at the facts. Our defense budget today takes the lowest percentage of our gross national product that it has in 20 years. There's nothing I would like better than to be able to reduce it further. But we must never forget that we would not have made the progress toward lasting peace that we have made in this past year unless we had had the military strength that commanded respect. This year, we have begun new negotiations with the Soviet Union for further limitations on nuclear arms. And we shall be participating later in the year in negotiations for mutual reduction of forces in Europe. If prior to these negotiations, we in the United States unilaterally reduce our defense budget or reduce our forces in Europe, any chance for successful negotiations for mutual reduction of forces or limitation of arms will be destroyed. There is one unbreakable rule of international diplomacy. You can't get something in a negotiation unless you have something to give. If we cut our defenses before negotiations begin, any incentive for other nations to cut theirs will go right out the window. If the United States reduces its defenses and others do not, it will increase the danger of war. It is only a mutual reduction of forces which will reduce the danger of war. And that is why we must maintain our strength until we get agreements under which other nations will join us in reducing the burden of armaments. What is at stake is whether the United States shall become the second strongest nation in the world. If that day ever comes, the chance for building a new structure of peace in the world would be irreparably damaged, and free nations everywhere would be living in mortal danger. A strong United States is not a threat to peace. It is the free world's indispensable guardian of peace and freedom. I ask for your support tonight, for keeping the strength which enabled us to make such great progress toward world peace in the past year, and which is indispensable as we continue our bold new initiatives for peace in the years ahead. As we consider some of our problems tonight, let us never forget how fortunate we are to live in America at this time in our history. We have ended the longest and most difficult war in our history in a way that maintained the trust of our allies and the respect of our adversaries. We are the strongest and most prosperous nation in the world. Because of our strength, America has the magnificent opportunity to play the leading role of bringing down the walls of hostility which divide the people of the world, in reducing the burden of armaments in the world, of building a structure of lasting peace in the world. And because of our wealth, we have the means to move forward at home on exciting new programs, programs for progress which will provide better environment, education, housing, and health care for all Americans, and which will enable us to be more generous to the poor, the elderly, the disabled, and the disadvantaged than any nation in the history of the world. These are goals worthy of a great people. Let us, therefore, put aside those honest differences about war, which have divided us, and dedicate ourselves to meet the great challenges of peace, which can unite us. As we do, let us not overlook a third element, an element more important even than military might or economic power, because it is essential for greatness in a nation. The pages of history are strewn with the wreckage of nations which fell by the wayside at the height of their strength and wealth, because their people became weak, soft, and self-indulgent, and lost the character and the spirit which had led to their greatness. As I speak to you tonight, I am confident that will not happen to America. And my confidence has been increased by the fact that a war which cost America so much in lives and money and division at home has, as it ended, provided an opportunity for millions of Americans to see again the character and the spirit which made America a great nation. A few days ago in this room, I talked to a man who had spent almost 8 years in a communist prison camp in North Vietnam. For over 4 years, he was in solitary confinement. In that four-year period, he never saw and never talked to another human being except his communist captors. He lived on 2 meals a day, usually just a piece of bread, a bowl of soup. All he was given to read was communist propaganda. All he could listen to was the communist propaganda on radio. I asked him how he was able to survive and come home standing tall and proud, saluting the American flag. He paused a long time before he answered. And then he said, "It is difficult for me to answer. I am not very good at words. All I can say is that it was faith. Faith in God and faith in my country." If men who suffered so much for America can have such faith, let us who have received so much from America renew our faith. Our faith in God, our faith in our country, and our faith in ourselves. If we meet the great challenges of peace that lie ahead with this kind of faith, then one day it will be written, this was America's finest hour. Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening. I'm Robert Pierpoint of CBS News. President Nixon requested of the networks the airtime to deliver the address which you have just heard. About an hour before the president spoke, copies of his address were given out to reporters, and Treasury Secretary George Shultz and Agriculture Secretary Earl Butz briefed reporters at the White House. In his address tonight, the president announced a ceiling on the prices of beef, pork, and lamb. He said it would take effect this evening at 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. That's about 22 minutes ago. The president is taking one other action, which was not actually mentioned by him tonight, but which was explained to us earlier by Treasury Secretary Shultz. That is, he is asking Congress for immediate permission to lower or remove tariffs on all items where prices are rising sharply and there is a limited supply. And he gave, Mr. Shultz did, examples such as beef, lamb, and plywood. Mr. Nixon also talked about foreign policy tonight. He hailed the end of the war and the return of the American prisoners from North Vietnam. But he warned that the communists still are not living up to the terms of the peace agreement, particularly in Laos and Cambodia. And he said, we insist that the North Vietnamese comply with the agreement. But the real news, and it was good news to many people, I'm sure, was the fact that there is going to be, and is as of now, a ceiling on the price of meat. With me in the studio tonight is my colleague George Herman, who has been working on the problems of the economy and covering particularly the agricultural sector. And I'd like to ask George, first of all, will this plan work, and if so, how, in cutting down price rises?
Well, I think, Bob, there's general agreement that it will work for a temporary period. A price ceiling of this kind, price controls, it is usually agreed, will work for a temporary period. The question always is, how will it work over the long period? This particular ceiling, and Secretary Shultz and Mr. Secretary Butz also emphasize that this is a ceiling, not a freeze. I'll get to that in a moment. That this goes for an indefinite period, but the administration also already said that it had expected that prices would start slow their increase in July, August, and so that I think we could count on that as being at least their goal for the time period. The difference between a freeze and a ceiling in the thinking of the administration, I'm not sure it's a valid distinction, is that under a ceiling, prices can possibly go down again. They're not frozen in their present location, they'll go down again. One other remark I think should be made here, and that is that this is a very intelligent move by the president. What he has done is frozen the housewife's cost, and at the same time, he said to the farmer raising live animals, I'm not freezing your price. He has not frozen the price of the live animals, so that he keeps the friendship of the farmer. Actually, of course, the farmer can't raise his prices very much because the price at which the meat is sold after his animal is killed can't go up. The middleman can't absorb very much more, so there can't be much rise.
The wholesalers and the retailers in this case are kind of caught in the middle, but they don't have many votes or much of a constituency. George, I'd like to ask you one other quick question, and that is, who is going to win this battle of the budget that the president talks about?
Oh, Bob, you know, you and I have been the way they were treated while prisoners.
Now, with the last prisoners set free, that restriction was lifted. This afternoon, three former POWs met reporters at Brooke General Hospital. Sergeant Ken Wallingford of Austin and Captain Johnny Ray of Oklahoma were captured last year. Master Sergeant Harvey Brand spent more than 3 years as a prisoner and suffered beatings and torture at the hands of his captors.
I was beaten on many occasions, although I underwent some torture.
Why?
Failure to give anything but name, rank, service number, and date of birth.
How did they approach you, Sergeant?
Normally it was sticking bamboo sticks into my wounds.
Master Sergeant Rand.
They took small, dirty bamboo sticks off the ground and put them in wounds and I guess a churning effect to gain information from you. I don't know of any soldiers that underwent the torture there that ever gave them the information.
There were 8 POW News conferences across the nation, similar to that one today. Immediately after our news tonight, CBS will present an hour and a half special on what the prisoners had to say.
9 years and 3 days ago. We don't really know how many there were after him, how many of the missing disappeared in a swamp or against a mountain, or how many of them died as prisoners, or how the ones who lived did it. Today, with all but one prisoner home, the Pentagon arranged for some of them to tell, setting up 10 news conferences for 29 men, most of them career officers shot down bombing North Vietnam. Their stories are of torture in North Vietnam until 1969, the year the prisoners of war were made an issue of negotiation, and for the men in the South, brutal living among the guerrillas. This was Commander Richard Stratton in Hanoi in 1967. American warrior bowing to the communists, later broadcasting for them.
I sincerely acknowledge my crimes and repent at having committed them. I ask that the people of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam forgive the crimes which I have committed against them. I ask that they spare my life and continue their humane treatment of me.
Why did he do it? He gave his answer today.
The man who read off the list of names at the Hanoi release, the airplane I departed on, the Vietnamese officer who read those names at the microphone at the airport was the man who composed my so-called confession from information that he had put together out of his own head and while I was going through initial torture and military interrogation. He threw those down in front of me as a press release form, a stack about 10 to 12 inches high. He said, today you are going to read that in front of a stadium full of people. I elected at that time to tape in a monotone the statement that was placed in front of me. When they were through, they put an extra sweatshirt on me because I looked too thin. Around 3 in the afternoon, they transported me to a place downtown, that I did not recognize. I was blindfolded. They played the recording that I had made from a room on the opposite side from where I was from behind a curtain, trying to make people think that I was standing behind that curtain, rather shy. And you all know I'm not rather shy. And at the end of my tape, they pushed me out and I had an instantaneous decision to make, somehow to discredit a so-called confession that was an absolute and total lie. I chose the method of trying to pretend that I had been drugged. I stared at a spot on the back of the wall. When it came time to bow, I boxed the compass in a 90-degree bow, which we were being beaten and at gun butt point, or rifle point, forced to do as a method of, quote, salute, unquote, in the camp. I boxed the compass once and stopped. Good old Dum-Dum came to the rescue, and in front of everybody else, barked out, bow! And I boxed the compass again, 90-degree bow, and was pushed back behind the curtain. I was taken back and interrogated as to why I did not do a polite little bow as they had requested. My answer was, you did not tell me the truth where I was going. I was surprised and afraid of cameras, and that I reverted back to my ancient Roman Catholic custom of doing a 90-degree bow, and for some reason they bought it.
Stratton said that up to 1971, he thinks most of the men were tortured. He figured 95% based on hearsay, he said. Today he told about
I have been tortured. I have been beaten. I have been placed in solitary confinement for a total of 18 months during my captivity. I have been harassed. I have been humiliated. I have been put on public display. For those of you that would care to look at it, there are scars on my elbows and on my wrists. There are marks from cigarette burns. They have bent back two nails, which have grown back in. They have so immobilized my arms that I could not retract my hands in this manner, nor could I lift my arms higher than this when they were finished. For any doubting Thomas, you can come and take a look. The marks are left. My Hanoi bracelet is here. My Viva bracelet is here.
There was another military news conference at Andrews Air Force Base near Washington, D.C. Phil Jones and Hal Walker covered it.
Collectively, these four Air Force pilots served nearly a quarter of a century in North Vietnam prisons, their experiences all the same, unbelievable physical and mental torture.
When you first arrived, they would try to get information.